I'm convinced that several of these chapters have almost a plot, like a play, and the meaning of the evangelist unfolds from step to step through the progression of the chapter. And this presents some problems for a Bible study on one section of John or a sermon on one section of this chapter, because in a sense the point is at the end. But if you don't go through the steps, you'll never get to the point. I mean, there is something about human experience, and that's different from furniture. You can buy a finished piece of furniture and move it into your house, but there's something about human experience that some things you learn not instantly, but you learn by a certain progression, by a certain growth. And until if a kid doesn't learn to walk, he can't learn to run, you know. And so it's very important that at some point the child stands on its own two feet. If a child never learns to depend on its parents, it will never learn to be independent of its parents. And so there is in human experience some movement, some things which you want people to learn, but you don't want them to stop there. In other words, there are some things that we learn. I have one of Holden's gifts to me has been the trip to Cloudy Pass. And you stop at Heart Lake, and you stop in the Grove, and you stop two or three times up the switchbacks. But my goodness, you don't want just to stay there. You want eventually to get up to where you can see Glacier Peak. But you can't see it. The Glacier Peak, I understand, is one of those peaks you cannot see from outside of the wilderness area. And so you really do have to go through all these days' journeys to get to that point. This is the way it was with Israel in the wilderness. That in some sense they had to get out of Egypt and into the wilderness and wander around and in a sort of dumb, not knowing where they were going for a long time before they could go someplace. And I'm of the point of view that you will find as you work with the Gospel of John that the fourth evangelist is in some sense unraveling the experience of Christ in the congregation in steps and stages. Now, those of us who have been raised Lutheran and have been liberated by being simultaneously sinner and saint and have been liberated by an experience of justification which surreptitiously sanctifies but is every day a justification, don't live easily with some kind of development or evolution. And there is enough crisis in John, there is enough conflict and confrontation to satisfy even the most Barthian of us, or Ulmanian of us, but there is, I think, in the teaching that unravels about the nature of Christ's experience, something developmental. So I think in as we have been going through the week in 1 through 15, one of the things that I think we discovered was, although Jesus quite clearly attended to human need, he actually fed the 5,000, and to turn a Passover celebration into a protest, so to speak. You know, in other words, to do a big soup kitchen handout on Passover was to draw out, was a fairly radical drawing out of the social implications of Jewish ritual. You know, and sometime to do something, I will always remember the Thursday, the Holy Thursday in the middle of some of the Vietnam protests, when we had the Maundy Thursday communion service at the campus chapel, and after the communion service we walked down to Bridge Square and met a group of people from Carleton and had a kind of testimony service. And that was one of the few times in my life that I have ever seen the symbol and the social act put together. I think there were times in the ministry of Martin Luther King where the connection, between the sign and the testimony were clear. But most times in our life, the sign happens over here and the testimony happens over here, and you have to have some imagination or some awfully gut feelings to get those together. But once in a while, if we're where there is a providence, maybe they happen to. Well, so Jesus does that. You know, he turns the fourth gospel, takes this old feeding story and turns it into that kind of a story. And then the crowd, he takes the crowd's motives and walks away from them. So that there is some suggestion that maybe one oughtn't to spend all one's life fretting about believing signs. There's more to the experience of Christ than proving the reality of miracles and that sort of thing. Even though that's where some people begin, that is not the place where we ought to stop. The second section, you get into the wonderful story of walking on the water and ministry to fear, and I'm still not sure about how tightly that fits into the argument of this chapter. In 16 through 35, I think with the phrase, because you saw signs and because you ate your fill of loaves, you have introduced another critique of or a challenge of another kind of faith. I call the thing in the first 15 chapters sign faith, and I call the other kind of beginning faith bread faith. That there is a kind of believing which believes in Jesus because it lives up to our religious expectations. Now, everybody's religious. Everybody has some kind of piety, whatever kind it is. So that when they run into Jesus for the first time, they, in a sense, case him out by how well he lives up to what our notion is of what God and ultimates ought to be. And that's where, that is, in a sense, where a lot of us begin. There is also a kind of encounter with Jesus which begins in the meeting of some gut level survival need, what I would call bread faith. Jesus gets us out of a guilt trip. Jesus gets us out of a family bind. Jesus gets us out of a depression, and it's good to get out of a depression, thank God, if Jesus can get you out of it. There is a kind of attachment to the Lord that comes from, or quite another kind of thing. I'm still up in the air about what to make of ecstasy. And there's some people that are scared to death of it, And if it runs the whole ship, I guess I'd be scared to death of it. But on the other hand, I'm scared to death of a life where all the yearning and capacity for ecstasy is suppressed. And so I worry about a life and a society that has no place for ecstasy. And I'm sure that if we leave no place for ecstasy, we are vulnerable to any cheap kind of ecstasy that comes along. Because there is about human experience there is a part of our being and a part of our community life that is passionate. And if we cannot be passionate about our hymns, we will be passionate some other way. And there's a long story behind all that sort of thing. But anyhow, I have a funny, I think we need a touch of ecstasy. I don't think we need frenzy, but I do think we need a touch of ecstasy, most of us. And I think it's not a bad place to begin for some people is with a touch of ecstasy. We need it. So that's, in my book, a kind of beginning, a legitimate beginning faith. But again, that is Jesus giving us something that we need. And it isn't necessarily coming to terms with the program and agenda that Jesus himself had. Because it's, as we go on in the chapter, and as you go on with the story of it may begin, and you know, there may be some moment of enthusiasm that get Matthew to leave the tax stuff, you know, the money tables, and go off, or there may be some great moment that gets those guys to leave the fishing business. But my goodness, it's not great at the end of the story. You know, the crucifixion is not an ecstatic moment. It's a very gross, fundamental. It's a moment like being born all over. I mean, real births of babies are kind of a bloody mess. I mean, there's an ecstasy, especially for the mother, and maybe if the father gets to see the mother in labor, he can get ecstatic too. But there is an ecstasy. There is an ecstasy that comes from the release of that child into the world, but it's really an awful lot of sore muscles. And for the ecstasy lasts a little while, but the pain and ache and the baby is real. For goodness sakes, you don't come down out of a trip. You come back from the hospital with a screaming kid. And you've got to get up at 4 or 5 in the morning, and you're stuck with the kid for 20 years. I mean, that's responsibility. That kind of ecstasy ends up in just an enormous amount of responsibility. So the cross, dying is like that. You see, there are certain kinds of moments where the ecstasy kind of leads into rather gut responsible living. So that as you move on into the chapter, you find that you see what I'm saying? Bread faith. There's room for bread faith. I mean, after all, Jesus did feed the multitude, you know. If he had really wanted to stomp on the bread faith, he could have said, forget it, we're not going to do this. Because you might get the wrong idea. Well, people might get the wrong idea, but you still better attend to each other's needs. Because life does have to survive, and it's very important to attend to all levels of human need. But Jesus isn't about simply attending, even though he attends to human need, even though he offers a moment of illumination and a moment of ecstasy. There's more to the story than that. There's more to the story than that. So I think that in 16 through 35, you have the sort of needling a little bit of spread faith and saying, you're really in here because you got a full stomach, but now listen a little bit. Let's look at a little bit. And then there's a kind of argument about manna in the wilderness, and they say, well, do us a sign. Give us something that shows that you're for real. And after all, Moses did this. Look at the Bible. It says that Moses gave them a sign, and he comes back, you know. Well, now, just a minute. Just a minute. Read that story over again. Wasn't it God that gave the sign? Not Moses? Wasn't it God? Was Moses really just a miracle worker, or was Moses a servant of God who was providentially providing for the people? So maybe you, instead of asking me to do the sign that you want to get done, maybe you ought to pay attention to what sign I am. And Jesus goes into the Jesus dialogue, where I am the bread that came down from heaven, I'm the manna. Now you're old enough, now you're on your two feet, you're able to pay attention to Jesus. You don't need to pay attention to how Jesus meets your needs anymore. It's about time for you to grow up and pay attention to what Jesus is about on his own agenda, and what God is about in the Jesus agenda. And so really without rejecting where the crowd and the disciples are, there is, I think, in this, when it gets down to verse 35, I am the bread of life, he who comes to me shall not hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst. Now, this chapter doesn't stop with Jesus' faith. The chapter doesn't stop with saying that Jesus is the bread that comes down from heaven. There are two major qualifications of the Jesus sign in the next two pericopes. The first is that the fourth evangelist understands Jesus. Now, you see, notice how very subtly one short-term vision of Jesus is changed into a longer-term vision, into a longer-term vision, into a longer-term vision. The fourth evangelist does not understand Jesus as an end in himself. Once you switch from bread faith to Jesus faith, the easiest thing unto the world is to hang on to Jesus and say, Jesus, Jesus, only Jesus. And there's something about Jesus that you're missing. There really is something about Jesus that you're missing if you hang on to the personality and behavior of Jesus as a paradigm for what God is doing. What you're missing is that Jesus believed in God. So what you see when you see Jesus is not somebody who believed in themselves, but somebody who believed he was sent by somebody else. Ever thought of that? Look at this chapter. Jesus keeps saying, well, I'm just doing what my Father told me to do. The people that come to me are the people that God sends to me. He's not even worried about it's very funny, but it's quite clear that the picture of Jesus in this chapter, Jesus is not worried about the whole world. I mean, he's for the world, of course, but he's really concerned about taking care of the people that God gives him. And I think that really one of the major demons of our age, church age, is a kind of Jesus anxiety, where somehow we have to be Jesus to everybody, and we fret over and we want to manipulate the world as though the Jesus trip were somehow connected with making the world the way we want them. And we have missed something. What we have missed is that there is something unfrenetic, something very, this is an oversimplification, but once in a while somebody like me ought to oversimplify. There's a kind of casual, you know, Jesus isn't a demagogue. He isn't running around acting like he needs to get elected. He isn't running around acting like he needs to meet his sales quota. He isn't running around even acting like the whole world depends on him. You know, he really isn't. He's acting as though he ought to be doing his Father's will. He ought to be doing God's will, and he has such a... And then this, for those of you who are interested in the history of theology, I guess I still think that there's something in what Schleiermacher said about Jesus' God consciousness. Jesus is the behavior of Jesus depends upon Jesus' awareness of the reality of being. And so it turns out that believing in Jesus is not just believing in personality or enthusiasm or a crucifix. It's believing in somebody who believed in God. It's believing in a sign which whose content is the dramatic articulation of the relationship to God. So that to believe in Jesus is to believe in how Jesus is to related to God. And we collapse. I mean, the early Christians had a big sweat. And I think that although we don't always talk that way all the time, and there are some problems with second and third century language, the doctrine of the Trinity has done marvelously good job of preventing us from being sort of Unitarians of the first or second or third article, whichever kind. I mean, there's something, and that's true to the story. That's true to the story. Jesus unfolded and spoke and articulated, worded a relationship between responsibility and being, between himself and God. Okay, that's one of the qualifications, and I think that's what all this language that led to the predestination controversies and things like that is about, and that's in 36 to 51. And everyone who has heard and learned from the Father comes to me, not that anyone has seen the Father who is from God, and he has seen the Father. Now there's one other major qualification that comes in the last verse, my flesh, and then is articulated much more clearly in 52 through 59, where we were yesterday. And in a way, this is the high point of the chapter in terms of the unfolding of the meaning of Jesus. And I understand the Johannine, the way I have, the simplest way I think that to understand John, or John's statement, seems to me to be about, consistently about the figure of Jesus. And I understand flesh not as primarily a reference to the sacrament, though I am by conviction and by party in the life of the church fairly committed sacramentalist. I understand this word to be pointing to the cross. The bread that I give for the life of the world is my flesh. And to function in this gospel, much like the predictions of the passion function in the gospel of Mark and Matthew and Luke. And then the great gift of this way of reading John is that I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, unless you share and participate in the sufferings of Jesus, unless you participate in the death of the cross, you don't reach life. And with that kind of, and it's, unless you, in Matthew, in Mark language, Mark 8, and you can compare Mark 8 and 9 with John 6. In Mark language, it would be, unless you take up, unless you're willing to not put yourself quite first, unless you're willing to take up your cross and follow, you'll never make it to the kingdom of God. That's strong ways of putting it, but these Jewish rabbis weren't above a good, strong hyperbole to get people to face up to some issues. So that unless you're willing to participate, now that changes the whole thing too, you see, because not only is it not the personality of Jesus that is the sign, and not only is it not the ethics of Jesus the sign, but fundamentally the Jesus-God relationship is the sign. The other big thing is that this sign is not, it's weird. It's a sign that gives life, but what it is the sign of death. It's a sign that frees you, in a sense, from suffering. But it's a suffering sign. And there's some profound logic in that. There is some profound logic. We were talking afterwards that it's certainly true of our experiences, our personal growth, that when we have faced our death or the death of a loved one, we are free to grow in a new way. So there is some, and I think, I don't know, but I think it has something to do with facing deep fear. The only way out of certain fears that bind us and the church is to get them out in the open and face them. And there are some fears, there are fears of living. As Walt was saying last night, there's a fear of loving. And some of this is about, some of the freedom is about getting rid of the fears that bind. Okay. So that it's quite a different thing, and it just cuts off, it just goes in, this whole business of the cross just goes in so many directions that just don't ever think that when someone's talking about the cross, they finish talking about the cross. All we're doing is scratching the surface, and there's more and more to be said. So for goodness sakes, don't ever judge a theologian by what they haven't said, because they're only scratching the surface. I mean, how much can you eat in one meal, you know? You can't eat a whole loaf of bread at one sitting, and we can't talk about the whole meaning of the cross in a week or not even in a lifetime. Not even in a lifetime. So, but there is something about this cross faith that you begin to see Jesus not only as someone who was dependent on God, not sort of God all by himself. And you begin to see Jesus as somebody whose humanity was vulnerable, whose humanity was real, who was involved in not some ideal trip, some idea about life, not some ideology about life, but who was involved in the reality of sweat and blood and growth and decline, of life and death, of success a little bit, but mostly failure. Mostly failure. And in many ways, this cross faith runs exactly against the grain of the American dream. The American dream is that everything is getting bigger. I mean, it was formulated in the frontier, and of course, if you found one, before we were smart enough to really figure out where the oil was, if you found one hole of oil, one well of oil, you get there was another one, and then there was another one, and there was another one. If you could have one baby, you could have a dozen. My grandmother, or great-grandmother, not my grandmother, my great-grandmother did that. All right. There was more where it came from. There was frontier. There was unlimited lumber. There was unlimited... everything was unlimited. You know, this was easy to understand. And there are many ways in which it's easy to understand how the 19th and early 20th century could look at our life as somehow the climax of an evolutionary development, and eventually we'd reach the highest mountain, and eventually we'd be gods. Eventually we'd be gods. And we were to look like gods, you know. We really, talking about the Greek gods last time, you know, the Greek statues are art. They figured out the proportions of the body mathematically, not by looking. That was the big thing in the Renaissance, where they actually, that was what really shocked people in the Renaissance, was the body started to look real, you know, and you get all these real fleshy bodies, even on some of them. They put some, Michelangelo put so much sort of juice and flesh into some, and so many little details into that Last Judgment picture that one of the popes made him paint it over. And because they really somehow discovered the organic character of the body. The Greek bodies weren't organic at all. They were ideal. They were ideal. They were visions of a kind of half God, half human. And that's what we live with most of the time. We live with visions that we ought to be like, and the world ought to be like, and America ought to be like. These things which are awfully pretty to look at, and powerful statements of aesthetic enjoyment. They're poems. They're music. But they're not flesh and blood. They have a touch of immortality, like a mathematical formula. But they don't die, and they don't cry, and they don't hurt. And you see, there's something quite different between art and the gospel. I mean, I think the gospel inspires and nurtures and has been one of the major inspirations for Western art. But Jesus just isn't an art object. Nor can we be an object of art without drastically altering. You know, that, how come a really good religious teacher got killed? So, you know, somewhere along the line, try to let some of your people in for the bad news that Jesus is a little bit like playing with fire. You know, you start out messing around with this guy because you think that he will solve your problems, and you end up getting a whole new agenda. That, I mean, you maybe get over a little personality pimple, but then you get into a whole new agenda that has to do with changing the whole system. And so, anyhow, in the fourth gospel, this is that that's beautiful. But I want to say something about the Jesus that risen. In the fourth gospel, there's a wonderful story about Thomas doubting, and It tells you something about the fourth evangelist's notion of the risen Jesus. Now, I always had the notion, you know, I've been reading those passages in Paul, corruptible and incorruptible, that Jesus is, that the risen Jesus is when there aren't any more pimples and there aren't, you know, it's ideal existence. It's the parousia started all over again. But what Jesus says to Thomas is, reach in and touch the scars. So the risen Jesus is not the ideal Jesus, but the Jesus whose death has been victorious. So that there is there isn't the dichotomy in John between the, in fact, in John, the crucifixion is glorious and the resurrection is the resurrection and the power of the crucifixion. So that there is a, that there is a hanging together. The crucifixion is understood. You can appreciate and glory in the death of Jesus because you know it unleashes the power of the Spirit. And the glory of the risen Christ is that he has been through the suffering and death of the cross. So that's one of those questions we could write a book about, and I can't, but I don't also like to leave a question like that unstarted. Now, I understand what I'm saying to be only a start of an answer to your question. It's a question actually you're going to have to answer. It may take 20 years to answer, but you're going to have to do it yourself. But let me share with you one of the first steps of my of the answer that basically God made the world and made it good, and the world isn't completely good. God made the world and intended a just society, and intended God made human beings and intended adult human beings, and the vision that God has for the world is not a vision that will come when we hang on to what we've got. In other words, what I'm saying is the security that we want is not a security which gives security. The security that Jesus gives is a security that ties into the nature of God's task in the world. In other words, the security that I want, you see, is comfort. The security that I want is to hang on to my childhood. The security that I want is to build my own kingdom, to build my own nation. And I want that because I'm really down underneath, there is a certain kind of, and here I'm playing off courage to be, there is a certain fundamental anxiety about being a human being that makes me want to protect myself. But you see, the only real security is security that is the point where you're in touch not with the level at which you fear life, but at the level at which you love life, the level at which you are open to tending to the tasks of the world. So that one of the things that the gospel is about is moving persons and congregations and a nation and a world, if you please, from grasping for the security, which isn't security at all, and trying to lead it into a grounding and a rooting in that which is fundamental enough to provide security. If you're on a ship and there's a storm, most of us would, first thing we do is turn off the storm. But the real security is to having a compass and a chart so you know where the port is. Real security is to know where the ground and the port and the earth is. Most of us, when we build our houses, put in stronger and stronger houses to
the real security is in knowing to where you put the foundation, and to knowing what fits that place. So that's a superb question. I think it's one of the most profound theological questions, and I hope you. Why does Jesus not give you security? I think it's one of the very profound theological questions, and I think when you find questions like that, you will muse on them and munch on them. You will find that they nurture you. I just have to, just with you a couple things about this chapter, and we've really gone. Well, you can finish it for yourself, but just note a couple of things about the text. There's a great rehearsal of all the themes in the whole chapter, and I've already done that. Notice the offense, notice that some of the disciples leave, and then there's something almost like Peter's confession, and he says, "Will you also go away?" Simon Peter, the spokesman for the disciples, says, "Lord, where shall we go? You've got the word. We have believed and have come to know that you are the Holy One of God." And then, interesting, even when you get down to nitty-gritty confession, you think it's all perfect and ideal and uncontaminated. And it turns out that even after the half disciples have gone away, you've got the real hardcore disciples, one of them doesn't get the point, or has a completely different strategy for bringing in the kingdom than the rest of them. And so even that last, the church remains fundamentally vulnerable and fundamentally mixed up, mixed. But notice that where the chapter ends, I think finally, is with a confession of faith on the meaning of Jesus. You are the one, you are the Holy One of God, you are the one to whom God has given his power and authority. And I think this is what John is about. John is about suggesting that there is a level of consensus an affirmation. There is a level of confession of the reality of Christ's shape and authority that is fundamental to the Christian community. In other words, what I want to suggest again is that there's a double level here. There's a double level of signs of the authority of God that I'm in. There is a level of preaching and Bible and ministry, which is somehow, and even in its own way, confession, which is somehow dependent on another level, which is a consensus, which is a perception or apprehension of the reality of the presence of Christ in the Spirit. And the church hangs together not because of this level, but because of this level. And not everybody in the New Testament says the same thing, but I think God is saying, when the chips are down, you need your consensus. If you want a really strong disciple group, you need your consensus at the level of the Lordship of Jesus, not at the level of the agreement on what you mean by the Word of God, or what paradigms of Christian experience, or ministry, or how you talk about sacraments. You need it at this level, at the level of the primary paradigm of God, namely the paradigm of Jesus and the cross. I think this is what Conrad Bergendorf was saying in that little book, Christ is Authority, years and years ago. He must have read the Gospel of John. And I think this is really what the fourth gospel is about, as best that I'm sure that the Bible, fortunately, is the kind of book that yields to successive generations new and deeper insights, and where we're a saint along the way, but it has been, I think it's an exciting stage. and I hope it will have some share in contributing to the next stages of interpreting the gospel. So, keep on with Dave.
I just have to say, you said it was the third question, isn't it? Because you really gave us the third answer. I really have enjoyed the discussion that we got from all of them, but it seems to me that if we don't come down and we can realize, you know, the whole scale of response is in the previous stage, then you've got a rush of going in the other direction in the country right now. And I just don't think we can hold them in line and say, well, they're, you know, they're on the right track too. And I think we just opened up a whole lot of excellence.
What's interesting is that from a plain historical point of view, the most certain thing about Jesus' life is that he died.
We don't emphasize that really in baptism. You know, it's like what you were saying before. If we told people what baptism really means, that usual ritual probably wouldn't occur as often as it does.
Well, you know, I must say that I wish I had a Baptist tank now and then, but even that is canned water and not. I think what you really need is a railroad creek. That's when you get the idea. You see, what really opened my eyes on that one was that Paul passage. You are buried with Christ by baptism, and all of a sudden, you know why you dunk them under the water three times is to make them think they're drowning.
So that literally baptism is the closest, the simplest, clearest way of sort of symbolizing dying. And we've just lost the whole imagery of it. I mean, you took them down to the Jordan and dunked them three times, and this wasn't such a just neat little thing. You got some idea of what you were in for. And I think you're dead right. You're dead right. And we somehow have lost the...